Join us this month as we talk with Harry Chandler about his family's newspaper empire and our upcoming historic cultural monument hearing seeking to landmark the Los Angeles Dimes compound. We also visit with Carolyn Strickler, who is company historian and manager of the Los Angeles Times History Center from 1979 through 1990, for a crash course in the personalities and powers of the post-war LA newspaper world. So stay tuned.
Can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long lost neighborhood called Hermina, between South Pass and Highland Park, Grand Central Mark. It is divine. You can't eat the sunshine, but it's a gold mine.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for listening to our podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the month of August 2018. This episode will have interviews with Harry Chandler, talking about his family's newspaper empire and our upcoming historic cultural monument hearing seeking to landmark the Los Angeles Times compound. We'll also talk with Carolyn Strickler, former company historian, archivist, and manager of the Los Angeles Times History Center. So this episode is nothing but the LA Times. So Kim, Pishka Maven, please tell us about the tip jar.
I'm shaking my hat at you people. I've taken my hat off and I'm shaking it. It's
no,
true.
No, it's the can.
Oh,
right?
It's a can?
Right. All the Jewish charities gave the can, the Pishka. Pishka can. Remember
is it,
your
is
Yiddish.
Is like a coffee can?
Yeah, the Pishka.
I'm not that kind of Jewish person. Okay.
Your grandmother your grandmother would be so horrified.
Not really. I've been researching my genealogy, and I'm part of this weird group of Dutch Jews who don't keep kosher because the seafood is so good. But that you don't need to know. Well, I'm suddenly getting more Jewish. The point is, we do have a tip jar. It's digital. And if you dig the show and you want to support what we do, like, for instance, all the time we're spending trying to save the LA Times from being insensitively redeveloped, you can throw something into the digital tip jar. It means so much. In fact, just this week when we went down to UCLA Special Collections and they shook us down for $12 cash to park in a very distant lot for the day while we were doing research in the Special Collections archives, I thought, this is definitely on one of our fans who's thrown some money into the Pishka pot. So thank you. Pishka can. Never obligatory. Always appreciated. Thanks for your support.
You know, I didn't make them reprint the tickets so we could park in a closer lot. We hit 7,000 steps without even trying because we parked so far away.
I know, and we got to see that beautiful Joseph Young mosaic on the mathematics building, so I'm not really unhappy.
Kim, let's get on to my favorite segment of the podcast episode, Closely Watched Trains. Do you want to start off with the frantic phone call from a concerned fan?
Sure. Yeah, this was exciting. So the Tower Theater is one of a suite of historic theaters in the Broadway Historic Theater District, which is on the National Register, and almost all of them are in various states of dereliction. They're not activated. And the Tower, one of the smallest and most interesting, because stylistically it's such a cool mishmash of sort of French and Indian motifs, it has been rumored for some time, some years, that maybe Apple was looking at it, which seemed strange because the building, when you walk into it, smells like mildew, and Apple does sell electronics, but it turns out to be, there's some truth to the rumor. Apple has produced a proposal to completely transform the theater and turn it into a retail space with some nebulous, very small-scale performance element, and, you know, it's kind of what it is. I mean, at least people are going to be able to go inside it, and hopefully the stained glass will get fixed, and the exterior won't get tagged so much. But the frantic phone call came from our friend Doug Dunn, who, from his building next door, high above the tower, was watching the fire department attack a fire on the roof from both sides. Very exciting. Electrical fire appears to be related to some of the work that Apple has begun, and happily, the good people at the LAFD took it very, very seriously. They dispatched two ladder trucks. They were on it. They were breaking windows in the Singer Building, and they took down the fire quickly. And according to the LA Historic Theater Foundation folks who have inquired, there's no damage to the theater itself. So, hey, a lot of excitement on Broadway.
We, coming home from UCLA Archives, we passed that intersection probably about 5 minutes before the fire started.
Or at least before it was noticed.
Yeah. Okay, Kim. Langers.
Oh, God. Okay. So, hey, Westlake's looking up. The story comes out, and it's, hey, the Langers building, the Langers Deli at the corner of 7th and Alvarado, at an intersection that since 2008 has been known as Langers Square, it's on the market. What? The Langers family has been telling people they own the building for years. Well, apparently they don't. They own
Really? They've been telling people that, really?
Yeah, that's always, don't worry, we own the building. It's so weird. I mean, people assumed that the Clinton family owned Clifton's too. They didn't. They bought it at the wrong time. So in any case, here's what's going on. So Norm Langer, whose dad, Al, started the place back when he was spelling it D-E-L-L-Y, Deli, 81 years ago. Norm is a man of mature years. He says, not to worry. Yes, the building is being shopped around for possible redevelopment, but I have such a good relationship since the 1950s with my landlord. I assume the last name of this family is pronounced I-A. Maybe it's Al, A-L-L-E. We're so tight. I have no worries. Yes, they're shopping it around for redevelopment, but my 40 staff members aren't going anywhere, and neither is the deli. Well, anyone who knows anything about commercial real estate reads this with growing alarm. But I have good news for anyone who's worried about Langers. So the proposal was put out by the son of the property owner. It's held in a family trust, and he says, come to me with your proposals for what you're going to do with this fabulous piece of property. There's a couple of buildings on the corner there. And my intention is that Langers be retained in some capacity, and you're going to tell me all the money you're going to spend to keep up this building, which needs so much work, which I, the property owner, have not bothered to put into it. And let me know in the next month. Which, you know, sounds a bit daffy. But if you Yelp this young man, who's not that young anymore, who is the broker for this project, you will discover people don't love him in Yelp. Seems to be a little unconventional in his business activities, and I think it's going to be hard for anyone to come to the table and make a deal. So now the world knows that there's some interest in doing something different on that corner, and maybe someday Westlake will be ready. But I think for the foreseeable future, Langers is staying put, because Langers works.
Kim, I have really good news.
Go ahead.
I just got off the phone with Meg, and he's going to write to this property owner.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Okay, get this.
Mayor Eric Garcetti?
Meg, Mayor Eric Garcetti. Okay, get this. Langers, pilot project, hovercraft drive-thru for Langers. They're going to turn the roof of Langers into a pilot program for hovercraft to do drive-thru at the deli. So they don't have to develop above it. And they can just develop all around it. 40-story towers.
Wow, is Melon Husk involved?
Yes.
Cool. Okay, well, I'm happy now.
Yeah.
I didn't hear you on the phone.
Meg with the save.
Thank you, Meg.
Kim, I don't even know where to start with this one. I'm gonna let everyone in on a secret. If you've listened to this podcast a lot, I don't really know where to start with any of the closely watched trains. So I just say that.
And
Kim, LA Weekly, go.
Okay, LA Weekly. We're recording this on the day that some idiot billionaire has shut down the Village Voice.
What?
Yeah, you didn't know?
No.
I'm sorry.
We were having the fight about the murals at lunch. That was the
I know, and then Dashiell caught a mouse, and we had lots of excitement. But, no, it's true. Another idiot billionaire who bought a publication and thought that he was smart enough and gutsy enough and had the skills to actually do something with it and wasn't willing to throw millions of dollars away every year, which, as we learn in Citizen Kane, is how you run a newspaper, if you give a damn. So RIP Village Voice. But what's been going on with the LA Weekly has been particularly galling for us because I mean, not to toot our own horns, but this podcast hasn't gotten a lot of press recognition in the past. You know, we hear from nice people who like it, but it's not like people are running around saying, well, this preservation and history podcast is really where it's at. This is kind of a niche thing. So last year when the LA Weekly named us the best history podcast, it was really unexpected and lovely. And then I made a little graphic to share on social media, and then almost immediately the LA Weekly was bought by moron billionaires who actually turn out not to be billionaires from Orange County, libertarian knuckleheads who've been running it into the ground. So we joined with the folks who were boycotting the LA Weekly because it just was really wrong what they'd done. They broke the union. They were behaving extremely unethically. They were changing the dates on stories to make it look as if old stories written by people who had been let go had just been published. The paper was getting thinner and thinner. There were some big questions about the coverage that they were doing, whether some of the unsigned stories were actually advertorials. There were rumors that restaurants were being offered coveted places on the best of list in exchange for offering support at food events. It was awful. And 9 months later, it only takes 9 months for something awful to kind of live out its entire lifespan and come into the light. One of the owners has sued the others. So now finally we know all the names and percentages of the people who own the LA Weekly, which is one of the things that they were keeping secret. And it turns out David Welch, who put like $250,000 into this thing, is extremely unhappy with Brian Kaye, I know that's how that's pronounced, who's been the editor-in-chief and kind of nincompoop in charge, and one of the few members of this team whose name was known during the 9 months of the LA Weekly's mismanagement. He's suing for gross ethical violations and financial malfeasance where the Weekly was actually used, Weekly staff and resources were used to promote and run an advertising company that they were running on the side. And it turns out one of the kind of small percentage owners, a professional skater called Nyjah Houston, if you saw him on the cover of the Weekly, you did not see a banner which said, I own part of the Weekly, but he did. So the lawsuit is really sad and troubling and awful, but interestingly enough, the folks behind the boycott campaign took this week, as the lawsuit was announced, to announce that they're starting their own, not a weekly, but an LA-focused publication called The Land, and we wish them the best, and we really hope that the end result of this lawsuit is that Seminole Media is forced to sell the Weekly, because the most troubling thing of all that we've heard about the LA Weekly is that the voice media people, the ad folks who ended up owning this incredibly important alt-weekly and others across the country, refused to sell to perfectly legitimate left-leaning journalistic professionals who wanted to purchase the Weekly. And instead, they sold to these people who were not only incapable of running it, but had some very ulterior motives. So if there's a forced sale, perhaps the right people will get a hold of the Weekly, and perhaps the Weekly will even become some kind of, you know, nonprofit co-op, which I think is the only really strong model for this type of publication now. So long live the LA Weekly, which is dead.
Thank you, Kim. Okay, I'm going to do the next two because we have so many more and we have to get through these. So just very...
That's because we wait till the end of the month
to record. Okay, that... Oh, that's it, really?
No, it's because there's so many things we care about.
So very quickly, and brevity in no way indicates our enthusiasm for this, because I'm delighted to say this. So we're talking about the Chinatown Central Plaza, where the Hong Building is, where Realm is, right? Hop Lui is going to reopen. Okay, Hop Lui is this iconic pagoda structure. There was a relighting ceremony at the plaza like 8 years ago, I guess, with the dragon. It's just, this is a really great space. We just spent the afternoon with Celeste, the granddaughter. Right, so this is just very much, we came home and that came to the feed, so the mind is universal. So just super excited someone is reopening Hop Lui. It's been closed since 2016, so a little over 2 years. And
Well, the kitchen was closed in 2016, and then they continued running the bar, which apparently they shouldn't have been doing because they had a special liquor license. They're supposed to be serving food. Maybe they were serving, you know, French fries from the microwave. But Richard, I know you want to go fast, and I do too, but I just think it's really worth pointing out that the folks who are coming in to take it over, they're not Chinese, they're not Chinatown people. It's Elon Kermani, who's a West Hollywood real estate agent, and J.B. Maresco, who's now Dallas-based events promoter, who's done a lot of Hollywood stuff, like at the Standard, the Roosevelt Hotel.
He's the idiot that took the original...
Richard, don't say he's the idiot, because we don't know if that was his decision, but he was involved in the writer's room behind Musso and Frank, and somebody involved in this, you know, broom closet that got rebranded as the writer's room decided that the best way to create this interior that suggested Hollywood's golden age was to gut the remnants of the original writer's room, which were still fully intact in this derelict room. So all I want to say, and I know you feel very strongly about this, but you can go for 20 minutes if you start on the Musso and Frank writer's room problem. And I know you don't want to do that. But this is my message to anyone who wants to take over one of these iconic dives. And as beautiful as Hop Luey Golden Pagoda is, it's a dive. Do no harm. You don't know if what you're doing is going to work. A lot of restaurants and bars don't make it. It's just the way of the world. This is an incredible, largely intact historical space, which people love, and it's really cool. And people want to go inside and see what it is. They don't really want to be tricked and shown something that isn't real. So focus on the authenticity. Do your best. Hopefully you'll be around for 75 years like the original was. But if you're not, when it doesn't work, you'll walk away leaving something cleaner but not damaged. And this is the lesson of what happened at the King Eddie, where people came into the fabulous King Eddie Cafe at the corner of 5th and Los Angeles, the last Skid Row bar, and had a bunch of bad ideas, which resulted in, like, cutting up the bar and creating dance floors and screwing up and screwing up and screwing up. And the end of the day, the King Eddie isn't the King Eddie anymore. And the people who did all that aren't there anymore. Please don't do that.
Thanks, Kim. They got it, the writer's room. I'm sorry. Perfectly intact. It was perfect.
Okay, I would have drunk there.
Okay, so quickly moving along. So the controller for the city of Los Angeles, Ron Galperin, has just issued a report saying that the tax incentives, which total over $1 billion to developers around downtown,
are since
2005, last 13 years. These incentives, which total $1 billion, have basically no oversight, and the criteria by which they're doled out is highly flawed. So, no big surprise.
You should expect a big change in how things are done, then, since the controller says that's not okay.
Yeah. So, we'll see. I happen to agree with the controller's report, and I'm not surprised. I think there needs to be a lot more oversight, I think. The bare minimum of annual reports documenting performance of projects that get assistance would be a great start.
And one really important thing that was mentioned in the story, which we linked to, is they don't look and see if existing businesses are suffering losses in revenue as these new subsidized projects come online. And if they are, that's really inequitable, and that needs to be discussed. I mean, if it's causing harm to places that have had a long relationship in the community and have been paying their taxes, is that right? And don't they have a right to know?
Good questions. We look to Meg for answers. As always, we look to Meg. So, Kim, I was on Take Two this week, Monday. Do you want to talk about it?
Was it that recently?
It was last Monday. Yeah, it was last. Okay, it was almost 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, so the long goodbye for Parker Center continues to drag along, and Richard, you gave a really lovely interview about why Parker Center is a significant building in L.A. policing history, not whitewashing the somewhat negative elements, which are very much a part of its story, but talking about how it was such a cutting-edge space architecturally and in terms of high-tech policing and surveillance technology and forensic science. And that was tied in to a really interesting piece that was published on LAist, which is now partnering with KPCC, talking about some of the other negatives of Parker Center. We believe very strongly that buildings that have controversial histories, buildings that have caused pain to communities, are much better kept around and used to tell that story rather than demolished as if suddenly there are no problems between communities and police in Southern California, which, as we all know, is not the case. So give a listen. We've got the link, and it starts at 40 minutes in, and have a look at the story. There's some great photos in there, too.
It was a lot of fun, and like 3 minutes before we recorded, one of the producers came into the studio and said, "Oh, could you just, you're going to make a couple points. Could you just write down the citation where you get..."
Make this incredibly provocative point.
Right, could you just write the citation for these three provocative points you're making? And, like, I did that for the first two, and then the last one, the one about Gestapo reversed engineered technology in Parker Center, is like, no, I've been told that by multiple sources. and they're like, so there's no book written about reverse engineered Gestapo technology in the LAPD. I'm like,
Not yet,
no. And they're like, no, we can't talk about it. I'm like, I totally get it.
I'm glad they're so careful. You know, you got to be careful talking about the NAZIs.
Yeah. So, okay, super fun. All right. Baltimore Hotel, Kim.
Oh. So, AIDS Healthcare Foundation has this new initiative. It's a new nonprofit that's dedicated to getting homeless people, especially homeless people experiencing HIV and other chronic ailments, off the streets. And they believe that it's a great model to purchase SRO-style hotels and fix them up in a quick and affordable fashion, and this is a better use of the limited funds that exist for housing the homeless. And they're trying to send a message through the media to City Hall and to the halls of power for the county that the model that they're using for creating housing for Measure HHH, where the community has taxed itself in the forms of $1 billion?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hoping to house the 50,000 plus homeless people on the streets, that if the ground-up construction model is followed, it's going to continue to get more and more expensive, as we saw with the development of the $700,000 deck at the set of little trailers over by Olvera Street that the city is using as a model homeless shelter, or it's not a homeless shelter because it's housing. It's supportive housing. But it's so expensive. And so Healthy Housing Foundation is buying hotels. And they began at the Madison in deep in Skid Row down on 7th Street. And they purchased the King Edward, which we were very pleased with because when we met them, we went down to hear what was going on. We went to the press conference, pointed out to a high-ranking staffer, hey, look, you know, you've got this wonderful, extremely rare stained glass awning that's been there since 1906, and a truck hit it about 10 years ago, and we've been watching with concern the beautiful opal glass sort of quaking because it's been hit by a truck. And they were immediately open to contacting Judson Glass, who came down and removed the stained glass and are in the process of fully restoring it so that it will last another 112 years. And that's pretty exciting.
Judson Glass nipple.
Oh, yeah. We just discovered a Judson Glass two-panel set at the old Stock Exchange building, which is now a nightclub on Spring Street. We had a tour of this lovely building, not during nightclub hours.
Thank you, Angela.
Thank you, Angela. And there's a really cool little anteroom, which was off the trading floor, which has a panel on the wall where individual traders could push a button and alert people that they were in the this special anteroom and could be called in at a moment's notice if needed for trades. A little light would go on over their number. And in the room are two stained glass windows of a male and a female figure, both topless. The female figure has a Russian wolfhound along her side, classic Art Deco, and she's quite busty. And it's signed Judson Glass, has a couple of little cracks in it, so we took some pictures and sent it over to Dave Judson, and he said he had no idea it existed, and he responded with a photograph of a very, very similar but not complete panel that had been in storage at the glass facility where they do their work, and this is He didn't know what it was from, but it was obviously a little more racy than the usual Judson glass, so he's going to go over and check it out and hopefully get it fixed.
I think they're going to include it in their book,
yeah.
So I think Angela can look forward to a very reasonable quote, because I think it's in Judson Glass' best interest to restore, because they want to showcase it. So,
but the Baltimore.
Okay.
I mean, I wasn't done.
I know.
I know. But the important thing about what AIDS Healthcare is doing, aside from sending this message to the city that, you know, it's so much cheaper, maybe $70,000 a unit, including the cost of purchasing a building, as opposed to almost $500,000 per unit to get this ground-up construction out there, and they're not going to have enough housing for the homeless if they do it this way. They're taking over buildings that have been, even though they're legally mandated under a covenant by the city, to be low-income housing through the year 2060 or so. The city was not holding the owners responsible for actually renting out rooms. So in the case of the King Edward, it was more than half empty. In the case of the Baltimore, it was a little less than half empty. And these are so many rooms that should be available, the cheapest housing in the city, in the heart of downtown, that just wasn't being made available to anyone. So the sad thing is that if they'd been operating properly, ordinary working people could have walked in the door and rented a room. As it is, now the people who'll be living there will be clients of AIDS Healthcare, but at least it'll be activated. It's going to change the street. And I mentioned earlier that the King Edward Cafe, the King Eddie Cafe, the oldest bar on Skid Row, had failed. Maybe part of the reason it failed is that a whole community of people who used it as its living room were basically forced out of the neighborhood. So the people who like to hang out in the bar aren't there anymore. Maybe you won't be able to run your bar quite as well.
Okay, Kim, I'm going to do this one because we have to keep moving. All right, so I'm happy to say that 1933 Group, the people that bring us lots of great things, like
great restoration good, people.
Great, they're great restoration people. They've acquired Tale of the Pup. Okay, this is good. They're looking for a home for the iconic Tale of the Pup. It'll be a great venue.
What is the Tale of the Pup?
Tale of the Pup is this hot dog stand in the shape of a hot dog. It's programmatic architecture. So it's pure Los Angeles fantasy. Okay, so what's interesting to note in this transaction, and I think that's why you included it in this list, Kim, is that Tale of the Pup previously had been acquired by Valley Relics, which is a California public benefit corporation charged with, whose mission is to preserve Valley relics, the history
signage.
Of Valley signage. Okay, so I think what you're interested in is how an asset in the possession of a nonprofit supposedly held in trust by the state of California, because it's an asset of a California public benefit corporation, how this asset was transferred to a LLC, and I don't know, but I'm just looking forward to it coming back online. And let me do this next one too.
What's the next one?
So the next one, and I just wanted to put it on the table because I'm concerned about it. So our HCM, our Historic Cultural Monument hearing for Times Mirror Square, which is the topic of this entire podcast, is coming up in the end of September. At the end of the first hearing, on the table was the fact that several of the sculptures and resources named in the HCM application have been removed from the lobby by Patrick, the new owner of the LA Times, and several entities, including Office of Historic Resources and the Mayor's Office, had brought to his attention before they were removed that they should stay intact through the nomination process. No one was making canonical statements as to ownership, but just please, let's just take a breath. And let's just let everything stay through. The nomination process will be over soon. And he didn't do that. So we're concerned, and I'm looking forward to one of the things being clarified at the hearing is I'm looking forward to Ken Bernstein, director of the Office of Historic Resources, making some clarification as to these missing assets. And then, Kim, I'll let you just quickly... Yeah, I know, we're going to get...
Do you have another sheet of paper?
No, we somehow missed that. Okay, well we'll bring that up. So Kim, the director of the Gamble House is gone, walked away, 33 years. He said he had a different. 28 years. He said
he had 92.
Since 92. It's a long time. He said they have had a difference of opinion as to direction the Gamble House can take, and so obviously, I called around, and no one in the Pasadena preservation community seems to know what's happening with that, other than the statement given.
I'm asking for the mic.
Yeah, here's the mic.
Okay, all I meant was, where is it on the list? So Ted Bosley, who's run the Gamble House since 1992, very quietly told the Pasadena Star News that he was leaving because of a difference of opinion about the direction for the historic house with USC, which, along with the Friends Group, has managed the site since it was given by the Procter & Gamble family in the 1960s. Ted succeeds Randall Mackinson, who was the first director and the person who befriended the family and really let them know how important the architecture was and became the spokesperson and the advocate for the restoration of the green and green materials in Southern California. So it's a really golden thread. There's a lot of institutional knowledge being lost. And the only, as I said, we've called around. No one seems to know as yet. I'm sure, as the new season comes in, we'll understand what USC is up to, if there is going to be some kind of change. The only hint I've seen is that I did find a comment from Ted Bosley several months ago on the blog of a young tour guide in Romania who is dealing with a lot of political issues because he supports advocacy and understanding of traditional Romanian architecture. And apparently this is quite a political thing to do at this time in Romania. And Ted Bosley let him know that people in California liked what he's doing, which is true. I'm a fan of that blog as well. And that he and his wife would be moving to England soon, and so would be in touch. So perhaps this is all just tied into a plan to retire to Old Blighty, but I don't know. I'm a little concerned, and we're all watching with bated breath to see if USC is going to start having raves on the lawn. Gosh, I hope not.
Yeah, non-trivial. Non-trivial. All right, I'm doing the next one, Kim, because we have to get through it. Okay, so this past week, four historic cultural monument nominations in Hollywood around the intersection of Los Palmas and Sunset, directly adjacent to Crossroads of the World, directly imperiled by the proposed Crossroads development, whose EIR is out and is very much about to get some clarification as to what they can and cannot do. All four HCMs, which had been cleared through the the Cultural Heritage Commission, they were all denied in plum in rapid succession. This is very distressing to all of us preservationists. Talking to people involved in all four nominations, this was to mix metaphors, this was a Saturday night massacre. Everyone just walked away really upset and confused and overwhelmed by the tone and tenor of Plum.
And confused that Mitch O'Farrell, the councilman for the district, who had come into the Historic Cultural Monument hearing supporting nominations, had shifted his allegiances and said basically, we're not supporting any of these until the project is further along, which was a big surprise to everyone who had been shepherding through these nominations. My theory about what happened is that the Cultural Heritage Commission chose not to take all of the recommendations of the Office of Historic Resources this time. There's a corner building called the Bollinger, which is directly adjacent to Crossroads of the World there on Sunset. And OHR said, yeah, some of these other ones should be considered, including the very important Selma Las Palmas Apartments Complex, which are three garden court units, perfect 1939 Hollywood Regency, never been renovated, cutest kitchens you've ever seen, very peaceful interiors, 80 rent-stabilized units, so important for Hollywood. But the Bollinger was the one that had the X on it as far as Office of Historic Resources was concerned, but Cultural Heritage Commission said, no, actually, we like that building, and we like that it continues to be used by as a creative office space, as it has been for all these years, and we think it's visually an important part of the street. We want it saved. And all I can think is that the developer was really counting that even if the apartments across the street were saved, if the Bollinger was gone, they had access to the huge parking lot next to Crossroads, perhaps they could do a development that penciled out. But if the Bollinger became a landmark as it unexpectedly did when the commission took a different path there, maybe they just weren't happy with the possibilities.
Okay, very quickly, I want to, because we're getting very specific, I don't want, this is really important, I don't want to get lost, I just, at a very high level, I just want to throw some stuff out. So, what we're concerned about at a very high level is Plum, in these four nominations, which were quickly shot down in the last 15 minutes of the Plum hearing, Plum members made a lot of statements as to...
disparaging.
They started to opine and make decisions based on criteria, which is criteria the CHC, the Cultural Heritage Commission, decides on. Aesthetics, design criteria.
Historic significance.
Plum concerns itself with things like affordable housing
and
land use. And so... I think that this is a really high-level battle between MEG, Mayor Eric Garcetti, his commission, the CHC, which is appointed by him, versus Plum, which is a city council committee, which gets final over, which has oversight over the CHC. So I think that this is the battle between preservation and affordable housing and how it gets worked through commissions, mayor-appointed commissions, and city council committees to the floor of city council. This is only going to get more complicated, and I just really want everyone to keep an eye. And Kim, I know you have one more thing to say, but I'm going to say one last thing. One of the reasons that makes this scenario, this situation, particularly upsetting and confounding and difficult to navigate and talk about and plan for is that the CHC nominations were submitted after the draft EIR was closed public comment. So, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but really it would have been so great if the clock had been reset and the nominations could have come in before the draft EIR, because that's what we're doing with the Times Building. Thank God we're in time for that. So this situation at Crossroads is just really, 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 really complicated. Don't despair. Let's stay positive. And Kim, I know you have one last thing to say.
Yeah, and what I want to say is the proposed Crossroads project, which, by the way, has nothing to do with Crossroads of the World. It isn't on the same property. It happens to involve properties that belong to the same family, but it's not Crossroads, which is a National Register landmark and is simply going to be reactivated. It's not going to be altered. I guess there'll be some building around it. Because the Crossroads project is so big, it's so much larger than legally permitted in that district. It's really more than volunteer preservationists and small nonprofits have been able to deal with. And the end result is that the nominations to preserve historic resources in the footprint of what proposes to be practically a mini neighborhood to the west of Crossroads, they've come in a piecemeal fashion, which leaves us in this really heartbreaking position of looking at just the street Las Palmas between Sunset and Selma, the landmarking of the incredibly important and beautiful Hollywood Reporter building, which, by the way, was later the LA Weekly, a Hollywood Regency building, which is incredibly important in the history of publishing in Southern California, has been landmarked. It was done first. It has a story to tell. It's quite a small building with a lot of industrial space behind it, but that's preserved now, and it may not be preserved forever, but it's protected. Meanwhile, next to it, 80 rent-stabilized apartments built around the same time, in the same style, now are on the chopping block. And the question needs to be asked, who's thinking of the larger picture? Why is the Hollywood plan so out of date? And why are people who are not trained city planners planning for the future and getting rid of incredibly important cultural assets and livability assets for the benefit of these massive developers? It has to stop.
The battle for Hollywood, we are well into it, Kim. We are waist deep in the thin red line. All right, Kim, we've got to wrap this up in 5 minutes. We have two more topics. The Fitzpatrick House at Arlington and Adams.
You mean Fitzgerald?
Oh, Fitzgerald House. I'm sorry.
I can do this in a second. J.C. Newsom, incredibly important, exotic clinker brick mansion, which has been derelict. They had crazy raves there. They called it the Elegant Mansion or Elegant Manor. And bad things happened. Some kid got shot out front. It's been closed for years and rotting. And we actually went down there with Nathan Marsak, the crazy the cranky preservationist, and shot...
He's crazy.
Yes, I love him. Shot a video last year, which I never got around to putting online because it was just really short and there wasn't really a story to it, but I had this video of him standing in front saying what a terrible thing it was that this important building was derelict and to call out the National Guard. And then we drove by the other day on our way to UCLA and it's covered in scaffolding and they're putting a new roof on. So I put the video out with the happy photo, which I still haven't heard from Cranky Preservationist. I don't know if he's seen it yet. We wanted to surprise him with that.
I think he's looking for... I think his dog is lost and he's looking for his dog.
Say that.
So, Kim, one last closely watched train. Someone made a documentary about us.
Nicholas Coles made a short film about our true crime tours and our preservation work, which are two great tastes that do go well together. It's called True Love/True Crime on an American Bus, and it was at the Sidewalk Festival in Alabama, and it
Birmingham,
won.
Alabama.
And what did we win, Richard? Because you've got the notes in front of you there.
We won the special jury prize.
That's a good one, right?
Yeah, that's the prize where they're like, wow, this is a really weird, interesting movie. Let's give it an award because we didn't see this one coming. Our programmer's notes indicated this might be a good candidate for a special jury award going into it. And now we're positive, so there you go. So keep up the good work. Maybe it'll come to Los Angeles. Yay, us. Okay, we have to stop. Okay. Closely Watched Trains is done.
There's so many trains.
I know.
So
okay, upcoming events, I have to introduce our interviews. Okay, we have one upcoming event, Sunday, September 23. We have our next Lava Forensic Science Seminar. Bobby Grace, prosecutor in the DA's office. He's head of the District Attorney's Exoneration Unit. He is going to present the Chester Turner case. This is a serial killer case. Wrongful conviction is great stuff. DNA, forensic evidence. It's fantastic. Okay? We're going to have journalists. We're going to have DNA forensic specialists from the LAPD. Bobby's great. He is a prosecutor. He makes a good case. He's convincing. I really like working with him. So please come to that. Tickets are on sale, and we'll see you there. And I think we're going to have some special treats. Instead of donuts, you might have cake, because it's Professor Johnson's last crime lab with us. He's going to retire. So we'll look forward to all of that. And so now I'm going to introduce, at long last, our guests. Okay, so I'm going to interview Carolyn Strickler second, so I'm going to introduce her first. Okay, Carolyn. So Carolyn, from 1977 to 1990, was, in this order, the historian, the archivist, and then the manager for the Los Angeles Times History Center. So when Otis Chandler hired her, she was just sort of the historian archivist. But this was different than the archive of the newspaper. So, like, people would call her, in, like, 1980, people would call her on the phone and say, "Hi, Carolyn, I need to know all the photos, I need to get a copy of all the photos Will Fowler took at the Black Dahlia dump site." Okay, well, that doesn't make any... It's the wrong newspaper, but just for... But my point is they would ask her about archival questions about content in the Los Angeles Times, the newspaper, and Otis hired her to be an archivist for the company, the Los Angeles Times as a newspaper, the history around the newspaper, and then later Times Mirror Co., this giant media company which Otis was chair of eventually and controlled the newspaper along with others. So as this became clear that Carolyn was obviously not the archivist for the paper, she was the historian of the company, of the newspaper, and then this larger company, then they changed her title to manager of the history room. Okay, and this is what's gonna get everyone. So if you're watching our nomination for the LA Times, and we always talk about the interpretive stuff in the lobby that's now been taken out and moved to El Segundo. Yeah, what Carolyn built went up around 1985, started in 1980, finished in 1985. All that went out in 2007.
We just missed it.
We just missed it. So, like, we weren't in the... I wasn't in the LA Times Globe lobby.
So, wait, wait, wait. You mean when all those knuckleheads who were destroying the paper came in, the first thing they did was get rid of a real history room?
And yeah. Yeah.
If I'd known that, I wouldn't have taken the meeting.
Yeah. So basically, like, the week before we went to the LA Times in 2007, I not having been to the paper in, like, 20 years at that point, they'd taken out Carolyn's History Center. The Chandlers took it out when they sold the paper.
Oh.
Yeah.
They gave it to the Huntington.
Yeah.
Well, I guess they saw the writing on the wall. We, on the other hand, showed up for that meeting with the web team and were so dismayed by the quality of thinking that was being put on the table in front of us that you said, I think I need to landmark the LA Times.
Right.
So you saw the writing on the wall, too.
Right. So this is all... Okay, so Carolyn is great, and we're not just going to talk with her about the LA Times. We're going to talk about post-war Los Angeles newspapers. We're going to talk about reporter bars,
yeah,
for the Los Angeles Times and the Hearst papers. We're going to talk about Will Fowler, the famous photographer. We're going to talk about we're going to talk about everything. Okay,
mm-hmm. Let's be honest, the LA Times never really had the colorful characters that the Hearst papers had. But I would love to have a beer with Jack Smith.
So I want to get to that. So that's our second interview. So our first interview is with Harry Chandler. Okay, Otis's son. Harry is has been and is and will be a great friend and ally in our campaign to landmark his family's former compound. Oh my God, I had to say it because it's true. It's the former compound, because of course Patrick has bought the paper and they moved out about what.
They did, and they moved to El Segundo, and just today, for the first time, a man on the street quote came from someone who was at the In-N-Out Burger in El Segundo. It's funny, isn't it?
Harry, we're gonna talk to Harry first. Harry is gonna talk to us about his concerns and his interests and what he thinks is most important around this historic cultural monument application, which is going to the Cultural Heritage Commission towards the end of September. I'm not going to say the date yet because it's all tentative, but when we get it locked down in the agenda, we'll let everyone know. But Harry's great, and it's a great introduction to this important preservation challenge, and so let's take it away with my interview with Harry. Harry, I'm here with you. We're at Grand Central Market, and we're here to talk to you about your family and this historic cultural monument application for Times Mary Square, a compound your family built. So would you mind introducing yourself to us, and we can jump into the deep end here?
Sure. I'm Harry Chandler. My great-great-grandfather, Harrison Gray Otis, started the Times 137 years ago, and I worked there in the 90s. My father was the last Chandler who was the publisher there. So I care a lot about that building, and hoping that we get its historical cultural monument status.
Perfect. Okay, good. That was a great introduction. So we have a couple things I want to talk about, and we agreed that you were just going to get everyone listening, everyone that may not know everything about your family. Do you want to give us in 1 minute 137 years of ownership and management and the whole kitchen sink of the Los Angeles Times and the Chandler family?
Tough to do in a minute. So, LA Times has been part of the civic fabric since 1881. Successive generations of my family until 1980 ran it, and then it passed to outside publishers that our family hired, and then fortunately, it was merged with the Tribune Company, which did not do a good job with it, and we ultimately forced the sale, which was even more disastrous for the Tribune Company as it went into bankruptcy for many years. What we never anticipated is the building would be sold, and we never anticipated that there would be threats to this, these historic buildings that are on the Times Mir Square.
Perfect. So why don't we, as a way to get into what we're here to talk about, which is the impending hearing with the Cultural Heritage Commission to consider historic cultural monument status for Times Mir Square. Why don't you, just as a way to get into this, tell us about Harry Chandler, who built the first of the three buildings at First and Spring, the 1934 Gordon Kaufman building. Why don't you give us a little bit about each building, and then we can just get into the thick of it, of this fight that's going on.
Well, my great-grandfather, Harry Chandler, took over publisher in the early part of the 20th century, and after the Times was blown up in the famous Union bombing of 1910, they built another headquarters, and by 1930s it needed even a newer one. So across the street on the corner of First and Spring, they built the Kaufman Building, which was a magnificent Art Deco building that survives today, where the Globe Lobby has housed busts of all of my ancestors who ran the paper. And then after that, they built two additions to house the growing paper, and then in the 70s, the growing parent company, Times Mir. The latter building is done by William Pereira, called the Times Mir Building.
Perfect. Okay, so now we have a good base. We're at First and Spring. We're talking about three buildings. So these, Gordon Kaufman is the 1934
right.
building. Roland Crawford is the architect. Roland Crawford, the architect of the 1948 tower. He was actually the supervising architect for the Kaufman Building, and was hired by your great-grandfather to be the architect of the Los Angeles Times upon the completion of the first building. So, really important architect. So, Harry, why is it so important that the city of Los Angeles accept our application for historic cultural monument status for these three buildings, which we call Times Mir Square? Why does this need to happen?
Well, no one ever contemplated that these three buildings wouldn't be preserved, since they're owned by this same company for 134 years. And yet, they weren't, because no one thought they would ever be sold. And now we have a Canadian real estate company coming in wanting to make huge changes, demolish some of the buildings. And so we have to sort of join together to protect these. But why these three buildings? Well, they're the only private structure in the city center, right? They have that position because they were there actually before City Hall and before the county buildings. So they've really anchored this very important civic plaza, and they've done it from the vantage point of the dominant media in the Southland for all these many years. There's tons of history, tons of famous people, tons of things that have happened in those buildings beyond just the architecture themselves.
Perfect. And so I think I want to just sort of wrap this up with your thoughts on why you think the proposed tower on the site, which we're very concerned about, I want you just to, let's just sort of wrap it up with your thoughts on the mismatch of this tower to the site.
We're very lucky in LA to have this civic center where the entire area is ringed with county and city and police buildings.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but this is something that's not a coincidence. Your family brought that about. that's a direct result of Harry Chandler, who built the Kaufman Building, working on that for 25 years.
Well, whatever its architects, we're very fortunate to have this. And Times Mir Square is the only private structure there. And in the same way, we wouldn't want an office tower next to the White House that dominated the White House, nor do we want an office tower to dominate City Hall. And so City Hall was always built to be the sort of tallest and highest profile structure in Civic Center, and it should stay that way. And so the ONI building should reduce its height, preserve the buildings that are there, and build a great-looking new office building or residential tower, but it should not be at the height that they proposed it.
Perfect. Okay. I want to thank you. We're going to publish this in a couple of weeks, and that we're going to publish this just before the second and final hearing for the Cultural Heritage Commission. So we're going to put this out and get a bunch of support. So we encourage people to come on down to this hearing. We'll publish the date of the hearing on the website. We encourage people to write letters. And Harry, as you sign off, tell us once again why we want to save Times Mirror Square.
It's one of the most historical buildings in the city. It defines Civic Center. And the product that has come out of there has really defined and helped create the city that we live in.
Harry, thank you so much. We'll see you at the hearing.
Thank you.
My name is Alan Hess. I'm here in the Seaview Tract in Palos Verdes, and you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
Carolyn, I'm here with you. We're at Dupars in Pasadena on the lake, and I would like for you to properly introduce yourself, and then we're just going to jump into the deep end of your life.
Where do you want me to start?
I want you to tell us your full name and your last professional title before you retired.
Full name is Carolyn, Carolyn Strickler. My last title when I worked at the LA Times was the company historian and general and manager of the Times History Center.
Okay, good. That's a great place to start. So you, I think, would agree, are someone, is you're a person that can give canonical answers about the Los Angeles Times.
I hope so.
Okay. So tell us when you came to work for the Times and what it was you helped put together in your first couple of years there.
Like I mentioned earlier, if that counts, that Otis Chandler, who was publisher at that time, had an administrative assistant, Freddie Miller, whom I got to know at the press club over a period of time. And I had started talking to her about some of my own projects having to do with Los Angeles history. I'd become really focused on LA history as a part of my own books and articles that I wanted to write. And out of the clear blue, she asked me one afternoon, how would you like to be the archivist at the LA Times?
And your answer was?
I stood there speechless. And I said, well, that's certainly an interesting idea. I'd like to think about it, because at that point, I was on deadline for a 10,000-word piece I was working on for the United States Travel Service Publication Services, and doing, as you might imagine, a long piece on the Mississippi River.
Wow.
And places that you could see and stop while you were on either a river cruise or a motor cruise down the Great River Road, all the way down to New Orleans.
That's one of my favorite roads, by the way. Kim and I take it as often as possible. So God bless you.
Oh, yes. I was in the middle of doing that. And she says, well, why don't you give us a call when you finish the story? I did that, went down to the Times, went up to the Picasso room, had lunch with Freddie and also Lois Markwith, who was really helped. She was the initial founder of the department that Otis had greenlighted to form a center of information based on a lot of the material that Jim Bassett had collected for an official centennial history of the LA Times.
Okay, perfect. Let's take a breath. That was good. Let's get a date on the table. 1981. Okay? Okay.
All of this was starting in 1978. Then 1979 is when I officially started to work in the department as the second person in there to Lois. So the two of us, with raw material, no shelving, nothing, went to work and started creating the history, what became known as the History Center of the LA Times.
Perfect. And in 1981, at the centennial, the 100th anniversary of the paper, the Globe, this is so hard to talk about because all of this is gone, God. The Globe lobby up until a few weeks ago had this tremendous display, a series of interpretive objects and exhibits, and this was all you. So do you want to just sort of walk us through what used to be there, and I hope many people remember and don't forget the murals.
Are we talking about before the exhibit was put together?
Tell us. Let's take a step back and talk about the Globe lobby before the centennial exhibit, and then let's just jump into what the centennial exhibit did to that space, and your last project with the paper were the restoration of the Ballin mural. So let's just give this full spectrum of how the Globe lobby had evolved over some decades.
I went to work there. The building was the lobby itself was very sleek, modern, and very cold, blacks and grays, black leather sofas where people could sit if they were waiting for somebody. The eagle was over on the wall where there became the photo exhibit, and the murals, of course, had long been covered since the 1960s. Dorothy Chandler and her decorator Jan Hornbeck, that was one of their projects to cover those murals and to create the look that was there. Trying to remember.
Let me interrupt you, Jan Horn. Could you just give people a sentence or two on Jan Hornbeck, who's a very important designer in the scheme of the Los Angeles Times.
Well, she was, and one of their main efforts was the redesign of the editorial floor, the library, the third floor particularly, where it was carpeted, never was carpeted, and sort of green, I remember, it was green with a striped pattern of some kind. But then is when they started the pod idea of connecting the desks, but little separators, mm-hmm. not, high walls, but little separators, so you could hardly see over them, and they weren't corkboard where you could stick things on them, papers or anything, because they didn't want the reporters to spoil the look. So there was some sort of instruction. You couldn't put anything on those little separators. Well, that didn't last.
I'm gonna interrupt you again because we're touching on so much important stuff. So really what Jan Hornbeck and Buff Chandler did in the early 1960s was transform this early 20th century editorial newsroom, this His Girl Friday. I mean, if you think of your classic newsroom with just the phones ringing and the manual typewriters and just
Yeah, exactly. And eventually, the typewriters were all put on the top of the files, all in a row. And they were there for a long time before they disappeared.
It's so really, when Buff and Jan Hornbeck redesigned the lobby, they redesigned the Los Angeles Times, which at that point the presses were starting to get pulled out, and so this building, which had been a completely...
Well, the presses were there for quite a while.
Okay.
After that.
And right, early 80s, the presses left. And, yeah.
Right, they were there after that, because I remember how exciting it was to go on that catwalk above the presses. That was really something. To hear those presses go and see them. That was the fun part of taking people on a tour of the paper.
I love it. All right, let's go back to lobby. So Buff and Jan Hornbeck sort of redesign the editorial. They redesign the lobby. The murals get covered. The centennial comes around, and this interpretive center, which you create, comes in. So tell us about this interpretive center, which has recently been removed by the Times' new owner, Patrick, and is, I hope, about to reappear somewhere else.
Are you talking about an interpretive center? Are you talking
I'm talking about the wall, the photos, and the linotype machine, and just
the exhibit that I worked on with Lois and Daryl Kunitomi was a part of our department.
Sure.
That was up. I can't believe how long ago. It was up for 25 years. Finally, the Tribune came in, and on the 125th anniversary, that permanent, supposedly permanent exhibit disappeared, and so the exhibit that you've seen went in.
Wow!
And completely changed the look of that of the lobby from what it was, and. Have you ever seen a colored photo of that for the first exhibit?
No, I haven't.
Did you ever see what it really looked like?
No.
It was gorgeous. The eagle was was on a pedestal over by the elevator, and there were beautiful deep reds, a red background behind that eagle. And the exhibit cases over on trying to get my direction straight. Where you go in to the right, there was a wall here separating. There was a video in the back of that wall. They had a film going about the history of the paper. There were seats back there, and there were two exhibit cases, one on each end of the room. And the exhibit cases were, I think they're still there, but they looked nothing like they did, you know, when everything was really beautiful and brass fittings on those exhibit cases and polished. You could see your face in them.
I love it. Tell us about the eagle, because the eagle's been removed, and I just quickly want to give a little attention to the eagle who I miss. The eagle that was in Buff and Jan Hornbeck in the 60s, the eagle used to be on the roof, right, of the building, and it gets...
And the smog, they thought, you know, if we don't take that eagle down, there won't be any, you know, because of all the horrible smog that was happening then. So it went into storage down in one of the sub-basements. And then finally, I'm not sure of, without looking at dates, I don't remember when it was brought up into the lobby, but it was there when it was in the lobby when I went to work there.
We've had conversations where you've reviewed notes specifically for questions around the HCM application, and you've said this period where Jan Hornbeck and Buff redid the lobby in the early 1960s. It comes back in the late 1960s as part of this remodeling.
But where it ended up by on that special pedestal by the elevator, it really took your eye there, and yeah. It was such a great focal point for that eagle.
Yeah,
and you know that well.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I'm getting ahead of myself because I remember what happened when Huell Hauser came in, and how the murals got uncovered because of that.
Tell us, tell us the Huell story. I was just about to ask you that next.
Do you know the story?
I do. I want everyone listening to hear it.
This goes back to maybe, I don't know, 1988, 89. Hauser used to come into the building for all kinds of purposes, but he happened on the original timeline that was there, the photo timeline. He happened to notice a photo of the LA Times lobby, the way it looked when the murals were on display, and he was absolutely astounded that those murals were underneath this covering, and I can't
aluminum
covering.
And you told me that.
And so he got on sort of a crusade. These murals should be uncovered, and he did one of his live broadcasts one evening, and I was out there in the lobby when this happened, and during his interview with Craig St. Clair, who was the assistant by that time, assistant archivist, who should come into the building but Tom Johnson, the publisher of the paper, got him on camera and pointed out all of these things that he wanted done. And Tom Johnson says, you're right. Yes, they should happen. So indeed, from that point, it was a 2 or 3 month project. Hired one of the restoration experts in the business from Santa Barbara. He and his assistant came down with all of their equipment, and they were there on their ladders for the next 2 or 3 months.
Perfect. And so let's talk about. So these murals are original to the building, 1935. Hugo Ballin, and do you want to go through the iconography? I can, because I just wrote the HCM application, so it's at the tip of my tongue.
One little point.
Yeah.
There's a folder somewhere. I don't know where it is now in the collection. There is a folder with Hugo Ballin's contract for that project.
Wow.
$5,000.
Wow.
And the restoration ended up costing a little bit more than that.
I love it. The Ballin murals, original to the building, you have several panels. The theme is technology. And speed. So the idea, you have industry in Southern California transforming the world. So oil, power generation, newspapers, the media. So a very forward-thinking, proper Art Deco theme of the future and power. And this is at the height of Ballin's career. I think Griffith Park Observatory is just the next year.
You know more about this than I do.
Just the next year. So this is the zenith of his career. I want you to talk about Aggie Underwood. Okay. Let's just shift gears. Let's shift gears some more. I want you to go back to the Examiner bar. The bar where the Examiner reporters hung out.
Moran's
is one of them.
The back room.
I want you to go back to the back room, and I want you to talk about how you were on television. Okay, so give us a date and put us in the back room, and everyone's and who's sitting around you.
Well, the date the Examiner folded along with the Mirror News up the street. This was January 1962. I think the January 6th was a Sunday when the last issue of the Examiner, as the Examiner, was published. So I went down to the back room with three other former Examiner employees, and we're sitting there commiserating and discussing what our plans were in the future. And there were other people, of course, in the back room at that time from the paper. And all of a sudden, doors burst open, and Maury Green, who is one of the anchors from Channel 2, comes in with his cameraman. And he starts going around the room asking the standard question, you know, what are you going to do now? So he got to our booth. Do you want me to repeat what I
do?
So one of the fellows sitting there was Phil Glickman, who was one of the Examiner photographers and a crazy man and an absolutely delightful guy and full of jokes. So I was trying to describe what I wanted to do and not doing a good job of it. But got to Phil, and he says, well, I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm going to get rich making plastic aphids for artificial flowers. And so that was the end of that.
I love it. I want you to take a second, and I want you, for people that were not there at the time and don't remember old downtown, the Los Angeles Times compound, as it still stands, sits at 1st and Broadway. The Hearst newspaper compound sits at 11th in Broadway.
Right.
So you've got 10 blocks separating them. And I want you to give us, to come into focus on the Examiner. I want you to give us a sense of this lost geography, because there was another Hearst building just to the west where Staples Center is now. This is what I want to do is this world around Staples Center is all lost to us now. This world you knew in 1962, the back room and Moran's, it's all gone. Can you just take a second to paint this picture of this hub of William Randolph Hearst's newspaper empire and the geography of the neighborhood right around Broadway and Pico?
Well, the Case Hotel across the street was another you know, mecca for not only the Examiner people, but people from Occidental Life Insurance, which was just down the street, from, you know, all the businesses around. And also at that time, at 11th and Broadway, on the, that would be the northeast corner, was where, if I'm not mistaken, it was, certainly it was in 1958, it was where the MTA was located.
Yeah, wow.
And Southern Pacific was still very much involved, L.A. Transit, mm-hmm. the local lines,
yep.
and so forth.
Wow.
And so that was that building. And then down at 11th and Main was the old back room, another dive, not quite the place that Moran's was. I've never been in a place like that. It was something. And what you need to do is read about it in Will Fowler's book, Reporters, because
yes.
he really describes it.
Tell us who Will Fowler is.
Will Fowler was one of the sons of Gene Fowler, who was Hearst in New York. Randolph Hearst, at one point, he was the highest paid reporter in the country.
Wow.
And he, of course, was a very close friend of John Barrymore's and did a book about John Barrymore. And that whole story is another amazing story about what they used to do here in L.A., you know, all the crazy things they did. And Will, I don't know, he was probably old enough to drive.
Probably.
But he was the only one sober, so he was elected to drive them around you know, when they were really out of it.
I love it. I can't do anything but ask you, even though this is taking us farther and farther away, I can only ask you to tell us about the Watson brothers.
Oh my!
Start at the beginning.
That's another. It's another book. One time, well, there were. I'm sure there were five Watson brothers, and three sisters, and the father. This is when the start of the movies, and everything was brand new, and
this is like 1912.
Oh, yes, you know, a lot of horses still around, horse and wagons, and I think they lived over near, in a house near where Angela's Temple is now, in that area, near Max Sennett Studio, mm-hmm. actually,
yeah,
which is the building
still
is yeah. still there.
Yeah.
Just landmarked recently.
Ah, wonderful, wonderful. But this is where a lot of the movie studios were, including Walt Disney Studio.
Yes.
You know.
Edendale.
Yes, that's right, Tropico. You know, one of them.
So the Watson brothers. Their father is working for Max Sennett, and they're young, and they have nothing better to do but to keep busy.
Well, but they're kind of stair-step. And when Max Sennett said, "Hey, I need a kid so high, so old," and then they would be recruited for whatever movie they were playing. There was thousands of them, you know.
Not thousands of children. There were only five sons, but they're in thousands of films.
Thousands of films. Sorry about that.
So they became photographers. So let's jump into the thick of this. Let's get to the photo archive, which has been recently
okay.
dispersed.
Eventually, they grew up, and their uncle George, I think, was already working for the LA Times, I'm assuming. So he really led them in that direction to become photographers, and they did. They all became photographers for one of the other papers. In fact, you may already know this story. Jim Richardson, who was one of the examiners.
Let me set Jim Richardson up for people. So Phoebe Short, Beth Short's mother, gets the phone call from one of Jim Richardson's reporters.
Oh, I know that.
And Phoebe Short, it's 1947, it's third week of January. The last she's heard from her daughter is another letter lying about her life. And this reporter has been sent by Jim Richardson, asked to call. Right, Jim Richardson says to the reporter, don't tell Phoebe that her daughter's dead.
We want
to really hear about her.
Right.
So just make something up. And so the reporter makes something about winning a beauty contest. And he's on the phone, and Phoebe's just gushing. Oh, I'm so proud of Beth. Oh, I always do. And the reporter's cupping his hand over the phone, saying, "Jim, what do I do?" And Jim Richardson says,
"Now tell her. Now tell her." And of course, the reporter told him off politely. And
Well, Jim Richardson gets on the phone and tells Phoebe that Beth's dead, and Phoebe becomes hysterical, thinks it's a joke, thinks it's some sort of sick joke. The reporter comes back into the room and calls the Medford, Massachusetts police, they drive over, and she's hysterical and she won't hang up the phone. And Jim Richardson's just like, "No, I'm sorry, she's dead," and the police have to come, and it's just a mess. We're friends with Jack Smith's son Kurt, and this comes from Kurt. So this whole back narrative of the police coming, Kim wrote her Black Dahlia Tour, and Kurt helped us out with that. But let's Jim Richardson, Watson Brothers Photography. Yeah. Let's go.
Let's keep going.
Well, one time I think Harry was working for the Daily News at that time. I think. The Daily News folded. you know, looking for another job, he goes up to the Examiner, talked to Jim Richardson about a job at the Examiner. And this is, you know, I've seen a really good account of this, so this is maybe pathetic, but so Richards eventually says, "So you're one of the Watsons, aren't you? And Harry says, "Yeah." He says, "Oh, okay, you start to work." And then in the next second, he says, "Now you're fired. I always wanted to fire a Watson."
All right, so we obviously have many more interviews with you. So I want to we have so much. We've only just begun. I want to end this. I want you to wrap this up, sticking to this immediate post-war theme that we've found ourselves in with Jim Richardson and the Hearst papers. I want you to tell us about Aggie Underwood buying you a drink at the Moran. So first of all, I want you to tell us where the Moran was and who Aggie Underwood was and how she came to buy you a drink. And I will note that a member of Aggie Underwood's family was eating dinner next to us when we started all of this. We sat down for dinner just now before I interviewed you. So the Moran and Aggie Underwood, and this will take us home.
Well, Moran's bar was on Pico, it should be 12th Street, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was on Pico. And without looking at the address, it was quite a while ago. But it was certainly not, it was maybe mid between Broadway and where the convention center is, on Flower, is it
yeah.
not? On Flower?
Figueroa?
Maybe closer to Flower, Fig. It's now where the convention center is. Oh. But that was the site of the old Herald Express. And so Moran's would have been walkable, probably, for, you know, people working at the Herald. I do remember it was on the north side of Pico, and Aggie Underwood's, one of her favorite photographers, Ed Phillips, took me in there from a project I was working on, and left me sitting there between two big old inky pressmen, and the paper had just been put to bed. So everybody from most people, you know, who would ordinarily go in there, were in the bar, and sat me down between these two men and said, "I'll be back in a little while." And before I realized it, sitting there like this, and here's a drink in front of me, and I hadn't ordered it. You could hardly see, it was so dark in there, but around the corner at the end of the bar was this woman, and one of the fellas from the paper, and it turned out to be Aggie Underwood, and she clearly would have bought me that drink, because the pressmen weren't spending any money. And before I realized it, I had another drink. And it was a very liquid afternoon. Let's put it that way.
And this was your entree into the world of journalism.
It ruined me for a normal life. Happily.
You are a pleasure and a delight. I'm so happy we got to do this. I'm so looking forward. We haven't even started to talk about the 8-Ball. The publication of the Los Angeles Press Club. We haven't even started to talk about Airline Row at 6th and Grand and all the bookstores. We haven't even scratched the surface of anything. So I want you to tell us your proper name and your last former title again, Carolyn, and we're going to say goodbye to you, only to look forward to more.
I just told you my first name and my last name when we started this interview. Are you trying to trick me?
No, I'm not.
So you and your last your last professional position, you were in charge of the archivist of the law.
I was the company historian and manager of the History Center
for the Los Angeles Times.
Los Angeles Times.
You're amazing. Thank you so much, and we'll see you soon.
Hi, this is Richard's mom, and I'm at Nate Nails with Kim and Richard, and you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine. Finish your soup, Richard.
And we're done. I'd like to thank everyone for listening to our latest podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the month of August 2018. Our guests this month were Harry Chandler. He talked to us about his family's newspaper empire and our upcoming historic cultural monument hearing seeking to landmark the Los Angeles Times compound. We also spoke with Carolyn Strickler. She's the former company historian, archivist, and manager of the Los Angeles Times History Center. We like hearing from you. We like feedback. So, Kim, tell us about the feedback loop.
We do like feedback, especially loud, squealing feedback. And emails to youcanteatthesunshine@gmail.com or through the contact link at www.esoteric.com. Of course, you can join us on an esoteric bus adventure or a lava event like the forensic science seminars. And it's always lovely to hear from podcast listeners, so don't be a stranger. Also, if you are finding us through a podcast app, you can review us there, and it'll help people who are interested in similar types of shows, if there are such a thing, find us.
Kim, do you think the raccoons that live in our garden like to give you feedback at 3 o'clock in the morning when they break things?
Well, it was pretty fun when they decided to take the wheelbarrow apart with their strangely human-like hands. Yeah, I consider that feedback.
Okay, good. All right, so Kim, we did it. We're in the home stretch. We have some upcoming tours I want you to call out, so take it away.
Okay, we have some good stuff coming up, and we'd love to see you out and about on the bus. We have The Birth of Noir, our tour of James M. Cain's Southern California Nightmare. That's on September 8th, a tour that focuses on the pulp fiction of James M. Cain and the film adaptations that helped create what's known as the film noir genre. And we'll go to Mildred Pierce's house and other fun places and talk about how important the voice of the working man on Old Skid Row was to this powerful and still influential genre. Then we'll also be getting into the crime bus angle in the middle of September. We'll be doing Hotel Horrors and Main Street Vice on September 15th. That's a downtown double feature about just these beautiful time capsule interiors and all the horrible things that happen there. The serial killers of downtown LA are so fascinating, especially the Skid Row slasher, my favorite case. Not the Skid Row stabber, who was just exonerated on his deathbed. Oops, guess we have a serial killing cold case in Skid Row, but the Skid Row slasher. And we'll take you to some of those incredible hotels that have not changed a lick. Well, not much, since around 1900. And also talk about all the really important entertainments that went on down on Old Main Street. Sleazy good times had by all. And murder. Then on September 22nd, we have a special event tour that we'll be giving for the first time with our friend Detective Mike Digby, recently retired arson and bomb expert from the LASD. He's written a tour that actually expands on one of our favorite cases from the Weird West Adams Crime Bus tour, which we'll be giving again soon. It's the case, we call it the Crazy Caffetz case, about some real estate developers who have a run of bad luck, and at the end of the day, there's only one family member alive, the elderly father who takes up with a young vamp who puts up with him for his money while running around with other men, and when she's written out of his will after attempting to murder him, she's very, very upset and engages in a bombing spree. So it turns out Mike Digby is also fascinated by this case, and he's going to give us an entire bus tour.
He wrote a book about it.
Well, he's got a brand new book, which has just been published. And on this bus tour, we're going to sort of compare and contrast 100-year-old forensic technology and detective work with what would be done today. So we're going to have one of the best detectives in the business walk us through a 1919 investigation, and everyone who gets on the bus gets a copy of the book. It's going to be a lot of fun. So we'd love to see you there on September 22nd. It's called Curse of the She-Devil, a true story of revenge, betrayal, bombs, and real estate in 1919 Los Angeles.
And do you think we'll have a surprise?
I don't think you're talking about things that aren't on the agenda yet.
Okay.
Let me continue. Then my most unhinged crime bus tour, East Side Babylon, comes on September 29th. We'll be heading out to the East Side for cases that will chill your blood and make you giggle. And I'm happy to say that as we're putting out this episode, it is the 33rd anniversary of a very important day in Los Angeles lore, one that features heavily on this tour. 33 years ago this afternoon... Or was it early? It was around noontime. Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker killer, was brought down by a group of very, very incensed neighbors on Hubbard Street in East Los Angeles after terrorizing Southern California with this awful hot prowl murder spree. I think he killed 13 people, and everybody was locking their doors and buying guns and putting chains on their windows and so forth. And they caught him, and they didn't kill him. And they turned him over to first the sheriff's department, and then the cops got a hold of him. And we'll go there to Hubbard Street on the East Side Babylon tour. We'll also visit the world's largest tamale, which if you liked hearing about the tale of the pup, that's a similar programmatic structure out on Whittier Boulevard. We'll talk about the Radio Shop murders, and we'll go to Evergreen Cemetery to visit my friends, the Carneys, in their wonderful mass burial site, and learn a very strange story that the Carneys told me about a burial that is not on the official records of Evergreen Cemetery. So join us, do, on September 29th. Then, on October 6th, it's Richard's Charles Bukowski tour, Haunts of a Dirty Old Man, starting in downtown, taking us to East Hollywood and Westlake, discovering how to find the voice within yourself that is great, even as a 50-year-old alcoholic postal worker, you can become the writer you've always meant to be. And there's some really lovely locations on that tour, some of which we are the only tour company to go to. On October 13th, it's Echo Park, Book of the Dead, a crime bus tour including a stroll down Carroll Avenue, the horrifying Hillside Strangler case, and a tour of Sister Amy Semple McPherson's house museum, which does include the most beautiful bathroom in Southern California, and I will fight you if you disagree. October 20th, it's In a Lonely Place, Raymond Chandler's Los Angeles, and similar route to the Bukowski tour, we start downtown, the young man who works in the oil business and learns all about all of the sleaze and misbehavior of the oil millionaires of 1920s LA, and then we'll follow Chandler through Westlake and into Hollywood, where he becomes an extremely successful, neurotic, miserable screenwriter and does some beautiful work. And along the way, you'll have some surprises and some noir-themed gelato. On October 27th, Halloween weekend, it's The Real Black Dahlia, our flagship crime bus tour. We do expect that one to sell out, and you've heard about some of the Dahlia characters today on the podcast in the stories of old newspaper people in L.A. They play a large role because the Black Dahlia case was investigated as much by L.A.'s newspaper men and women as it was by the police. And then, very special new tour. We are launching November 10th with Greg Sutter, who is amazing. It's called Elmore Leonard in Hollywood, and for 30-some years, Greg was the writer and screenwriter Elmore Leonard's researcher and assistant. He knows him like no one else, and we are going to follow the extraordinary adventures of Elmore Leonard as a Hollywood player who had a really special career. I think he and Raymond Chandler would have had great conversations if they ever had an opportunity to coincide in the world. I'm not sure they ever did. But the notion of living in Michigan, flying into L.A.,
4 days a week,
doing the screenwriting work, making the money, and then getting the hell out of Dodge so you could write your books because you knew those would actually stand in stone and not be wrecked by idiots. That's something that Raymond Chandler could have learned to do and would have made him a lot happier. So that's what's coming up. We would love to see you on the bus or at the Crime Lab. Join us, too.
All right, great. So I want to thank everyone at home for listening. I want to encourage you to continue to listen, and I want to remind you...
You can't eat the sunshine.
You can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La, 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long-lost neighborhood. called Herbina between a South Pass and Highland Park, Grand Central Park. It is divine. You can't eat the sunshine, but it's a gold mine of fabulous oddities like brew, here's dairy.